Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode 205 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. And in today's podcast, I will be continuing the microbiology review for the US Civil Step 1 exam. I hope you find this to be high yield, so I'm just going to jump right into it. So, what is the bug that is best described by the following information cluster? Right, so typhoid fever, bloody diarrhea, osteomyelitis in a sickle cell patient. What should you be thinking about? Well, I really hope you're telling me something about Salmonella, right? So remember, Salmonella species can cause a bunch of problems on MBME exams, right? So they can cause typhoid fever, right? That's classically caused by Salmonella typhi, right? And usually on MBME exams, they will tell you that, oh, you can see rose spots on the abdomen. Or they may say something along the lines of you seeing like salmon-colored lesions on the abdomen in a person that has high fevers. If you see that, you want to think about typhoid fever from Salmonella typhi. But just to integrate some rheumatology here, your friends at the MBME can also give you a question about a person that has salmon-colored lesions on the skin, right, or even on the abdomen. But they tell you that those lesions seem to be evanescent. What do I mean by the word evanescent, right? Evanescent is almost like vanishing, right? So that thing seems to come with a fever, and then it seems to go with a fever. And it seems to come at fairly regular intervals, and the person will have like joint pain and all those things. If you see that, and let's assume it's like a chronic problem that has been going on for like weeks, if you see that on an MBME exam, the thing you absolutely want to think about is Still's disease, right? That's like the systemic form of juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. Again, it's absolutely high yield to know that for tests, right? And again, remember, Salmonella can cause bloody diarrhea, especially again when you consume like infected like poultry and all that stuff, right? And then if you see a sickle cell disease patient with osteomyelitis, that's going to be Salmonella, right? So that's a simple one. And the bloody diarrhea from Salmonella is caused by Salmonella enteritidis, okay? Not Salmonella typhi. Salmonella typhi causes typhoid fever, but Salmonella enteritidis causes a bloody diarrhea, right? Enteritidis, so enteric, which is referring to your GI tract. Now, what is the bug that is best described by the following info cluster, right? So this bug has fecal-oral transmission. You only need about 10 organisms to cause havoc, right? And this bug causes a really nasty bloody diarrhea that usually is preceded by watery diarrhea, but you can just say this bug for the most part just causes bloody diarrhea, right? And the gastroenteritis caused by this bug is mediated by toxins. What's your diagnosis here? I hope you're telling me about Shigella, right? I hope you're telling me about Shigella, right? So remember, Shigella is your friends at the MBME love to test it closely with Salmonella, right? Remember that Salmonella is motile, but Shigella is non-motile, okay? And also do not forget that Shigella produces hydrogen sulfide, that's what I mean by H2S, on TSI agar. Shigella does not produce the hydrogen sulfide on TSI agar, but Salmonella does, right? So that's something high yield to know, right? And the thing is, Shigella, you can actually treat it with antibiotics, right? Although, again, usually supportive care is what you try. But one that is absolutely high yield to know that you essentially should never give antibiotics for these on an MBME exam is if a person has enterohemorrhagic E. coli, right? So if a person has E. coli 0157H7, right? If you pick antibiotic therapy as your answer choice, I can promise you, you essentially get it wrong on a test, right? There are very few reasons to pick antibiotic therapy for EHEC, right? So, because again, if you kill more of the bug, right, you release more of the toxin, right, and you raise the person's risk of having hemolytic uremic syndrome and having other dangerous sequelae, right? So, that's something you'd like to avoid on a test. Now, what is the bug that is best described by the following information cluster, right? So, this bug causes a malt lymphoma, okay? It causes peptic ulcer disease. It's urease positive. It can also cause gastric cancer, right? And it's treated with triple therapy, as you'll see in a bit, quadruple therapy. What bug am I referring to here? Well, I hope you're thinking about H. pylori, right? I really hope you're thinking about H. pylori, right? So again, remember that H. pylori is urease positive, right? So it can make things that can neutralize stomach acid. That's why it's sturdy and it can survive in the stomach, right? But all that, it essentially induces almost like a chronic inflammatory state in the stomach, right? And whenever you have chronic inflammation, right, your immune system cells are reproducing like crazy. And whenever you go through more cell cycles, in general, you just render yourself more susceptible to genetic errors, which can increase your risk of a lymphoma or some kind of malignancy, right? I mean, think about it. This is one of the reasons why OCPs decrease the risk of ovarian cancer, because you just have fewer menstrual cycles, right? So there's less breakdown of the ovarian epithelium and repair, so you're less likely to get an ovarian malignancy with that, right? So again, that's a higher thing to know. And remember, the way we treat H. pylori, right? We use triple therapy. You can remember it easily by the word CAP, right? So like clarithromycin, which is a macrolide, amoxicillin, right, which is a peptidoglycan inhibitor, I guess, and then a PPI, right, so a proton pump inhibitor like omeprazole, lansoprazole, esomeprazole, and things like that, right? Alternatively, you could also use quadruple therapy on your exams. This shows up less often, but it does show up, right? And you want to know that that's the combination of like metronidazole, bismuth, subsalicylate, right? Or you can just say bismuth. I love chemistry, so, you know, I kind of love mentioning the phonemes of things. But so metronidazole, bismuth, right, tetracycline, right, or any other kind of there are many kinds of tetracyclines, right, like doxycycline, for example, and then you also throw in a PPI, right? And remember that tetracyclines, right, if you're less than 8 years old on an MBM exam, you're not getting tetracyclines. There's one exception to that rule, that's Rocky Mountain spotted fever. Rocky Mountain spotted fever is almost like 100% fatal if you don't treat with doxycycline. Right, so doxycycline is the drug of choice for all ages with one exception, that's pregnant women. Pregnant women, we typically treat them with chloramphenicol whenever they have Rocky Mountain spotted fever. But pretty much anyone, you just disregard that less than 8-year-old business for tetracyclines in general. And you know, you just give it to everyone for Rocky Mountain spotted fever. And remember, that is caused by Rickettsia rickettsii, right? That's important to know for tests. And then don't forget that, you know, you want to be careful giving tetracycline, right? Because if you take it with like a magnesium salt or a calcium salt or whatever, it can chelate those things. I mean, like those things can chelate it, or it can do the reverse, right? And that can cause a lot of problems. So you may not reabsorb the drug, or you won't get any effect from the drug. And if you want more on micropharmacology, I've made some very in-depth podcasts that essentially cover everything you need to know about micropharmacology for the USMLEs, right? Especially step one. So I'll encourage you, just go on the website. I know it's an episode in the, just go to the website, click on exam topics lists. It'll take you to a Google Doc. And then you see under pharmacology, or even under micro, you'll see everything that I list out there. Again, just kind of important, smart thing to do there. Okay, so this is H. pylori. Okay, so let's keep progressing. Now, supply the organisms that are associated with the following. Whooping cough, what is that? That's Bordetella pertussis, right? That's Bordetella pertussis. Bordetella pertussis is actually kind of high yield to know for many reasons on exams. First one is, it's a bacterial infection, right? But usually when you see bacterial infections, you know, obviously you have a leukocytosis, and the leukocytosis is usually from neutrophils, right? That's not the case with Bordetella pertussis. It's vaccine preventable, but yes, whenever you get a Bordetella infection, you have a leukocytosis, but it's actually a lymphocyte predominant leukocytosis. That's why it's unique and high yield to know for the USMLEs, right? Because it's a bacterial infection, but you're like, lymphocytes, right? So those that kind of thing may cause people to overthink the question and not pick Bordetella pertussis, right? So that's something high yield to know. And then another important thing to know about Bordetella is that your white count can get so high, you can almost think the person has a white blood cell malignancy, right? Like you can see people that have pertussis and their white blood cell count is like 70,000, right? So that's just something you need to watch out for on exams. And then another important thing to know is that if the way you treat whooping cough, right, from Bordetella pertussis is you treat it with macrolides. You can treat it with like erythromycin, azithromycin, or whatever floats your boat, whatever macrolide that floats your boat. And if you're a close contact of a person that has whooping cough, you also deserve macrolide prophylaxis so that you do not get into trouble, right? And the thing is, the classic way, because, right, many people see what I'm writing here, whooping cough, no. That's highly unlikely. Like, oh, the MBM is not going to write a question where, I mean, I'll be surprised. I mean, if you see that, you're like, you should be like, oh, thank you, Lord. I've seen an easy question here, right? Where they tell you that a person is coughing, and they have an inspiratory whoop, right? That is highly unlikely to be what you'll see on an exam. What you'll likely see on an exam is a person that coughs so much, they vomit after they cough, right? So they have like a post-tussive emesis, right? Or they tell you that the person coughs so hard that they have an apneic episode after they cough. Or they tell you that the person coughs so hard, they have subconjunctival hemorrhage. If you see any of those things, that's Bordetella pertussis on your exam. That's whooping cough. That's the presentation you'll see on an MBM exam. Now, if a person has indolent fevers, right? So what are you thinking about? Indolent fevers. That's brucellosis, right? That's brucella. And then, what's the gram-negative cause of otitis media? Don't say strep pneumo. Strep pneumo is gram-positive. So what are you thinking about here? That'll be Moraxella catarrhalis, right? That'll be Moraxella catarrhalis, okay? And then, pneumonia from air conditioning slash a water source. I don't know. I feel like on NBME exams, they almost always talk about this. Like, people getting this kind of pneumonia when they go to, like, a resort, or they go for, like, a business conference, or they go to a place with a waterfall or something, right? And then they'll tell you that this person has pneumonia and this person has like hyponatremia. In fact, I think of this thing as being like pneumonia plus, right? The person have like pneumonia, hyponatremia, diarrhea, right? And you check a urinary antigen to make the diagnosis. This is Legionella, right? It's Legionella. And then a pseudoappendicitis like diarrhea. It's going to be a bloody diarrhea, right? This is Yersinia, right? That's Yersinia enterocolitica. Okay, right, so those are the answers there. I think I've kind of like talked about all this stuff, so I'm going to keep chugging along. I'm really excited today. Let me not just say I'm really excited today. I'm just really excited in general whenever I get to teach. Whenever like one of the things that truly gives me excitement is just teaching, right? Like whenever I'm making this podcast, I'm like, yes, I'm about to put out one new podcast. I'm like super excited. I'm like, yes, my day has been made. Yeah, I love teaching, as hopefully you can tell. Okay. And this gram-negative cause of otitis media, I put Haemophilus influenza, not H-flu type B, but I'm thinking more like non-typeable H-flu. Because remember, right, most people get the H-flu type B vaccine these days. But also don't forget Moraxella catarrhalis. Moraxella catarrhalis is a gram-negative organism, right? So it could be either or on an NBME exam. Now, what is the bug that is best described by the following information cluster, right? So like burn patients, wet environments, this one should be easy. Pneumonia in diabetic patients, otitis externa, right? So an external ear infection. Osteomyelitis in a diabetic, hot top folliculitis, okay? Blue-green pigment. And you want to know what causes that blue-green pigment? I'll talk about that on the following slide. And then you can treat this with ticarcillin or piperacillin with tazobactam. What bug am I talking about here? I would hope you're telling me that this is Pseudomonas, right? Don't take any USMLE exam from step one to step three if you don't know everything possible about Pseudomonas, right? So Pseudomonas, remember, right, again, it loves to cause problems in burn patients, right? Like skin infections, skin and soft tissue infections in burn patients, right? Loves wet environments. Or if you're wearing like a canvas or something, right, and you get stuck on a nail and develop an osteomyelitis, think about Pseudomonas, right? Osteomyelitis in a diabetic, I'm going to make some reservations on that. I would just say don't take that as gospel, right? It may look at, I feel like the context of the question is what will likely lead you to the correct diagnosis under those circumstances. The blue-green pigment, if I'm not mistaken, it's from something known as pyocyanin, P-Y-O-C-Y-A-N-I-N, right? So you may say, Divine, that sounds really low yield. Remember, you're taking step one. I'll just leave it at that. And then remember, it causes hot tub folliculitis, right? So if they describe like a swimmer or a person that uses a hot tub and they have like this skin infection, you absolutely want to think about Pseudomonas under those circumstances, right? And remember, again, it's a gram-negative organism. It's oxidase positive, right? And remember that it has an association with cystic fibrosis. Remember, people that have cystic fibrosis that are less than 20 years old, if they get a pneumonia, the most common cause is Staph aureus, usually MRSA. But if they are more than 20 years old, the most common cause of pneumonia in those folks is Pseudomonas aeruginosa, right? So that's something you want to commit to memory. And I just put one of the treatment options for Pseudomonas here. I put like ticarcillin. And you probably not see ticarcillin on your exam, although it's a name to know. It may show up on a test. But piperacillin tazobactam is one that pops up a lot, but it's floridly high yield to know the other drugs that cover Pseudomonas on an NBME exam. So what are those drugs? Well, they're drugs like Aztreonam. Remember, that's a monobactam. Remember, it doesn't have those cross-reactivity with the other penicillins. Your fluoroquinolones, right? Ciprofloxacin, levofloxacin, gadifloxacin, moxifloxacin, naledexic acid. Those all cover Pseudomonas, right? Your aminoglycosides, gentamicin, neomycin, amikacin, tobramycin, streptomycin. Those all cover Pseudomonas, right? And then remember the third generation cephalosporin, ceftazidime, also covers Pseudomonas. Ceftriaxone is a third generation cephalosporin, but it has no activity against Pseudomonas. Do not make that mistake on your exam, right? And then the fourth generation cephalosporin, at least the only one you need to know for your test, cefepime. Cefepime also has the ability to cover Pseudomonas. And then if you also look at your, like, your nuclear weapon drugs, right? So like your what are these things called? Your carbapenems, right? So like ertapenem, doripenem, meropenem, right? Those drugs also cover Pseudomonas as well. So again, all the drugs that cover good old Pseudomonas, you gotta know those for your test. Please, I'm begging you, please know them. If not, you run into a lot of problems on step one, step two CK, and step three. Okay, now pneumonia, right? So let me just have a quick, you know, talking slide on pneumonia, right? So again, pneumonia, super high up for your test. Obviously, pneumonia is associated with like inflammation of the alveoli. Those are those little bags in your lungs, right? And you can have two types of pneumonia on an NBME, right? So there's the typical pneumonia and there's the atypical pneumonia. What's the key difference? Well, typical pneumonias are pneumonias where you have an acute onset of symptoms, right? Like you're like, I was fine 2 days ago, but yesterday, man, I just felt completely knocked down, right? Acute onset of symptoms, very high fevers. In fact, there is this attendant I worked with during my intern year that describes the pneumococcal pneumonia fever as like a teeth chattering fever, right? Like, you know you're sick, right? Acute onset symptoms, very severe symptoms. Think about a typical pneumonia under those circumstances. The atypical ones, usually you find that in a young person, right? So in a person that's like a teenager, 20s, 30s on an NBM exam, you'll have like subacute symptoms. So, you know, if they've kind of been feeling like crap for like a week, they're still able to hold down their jobs, they don't have super high fevers, you look at the chest x-ray and like, wow, this chest x-ray looks worse than the patient. Whenever you see things like that, then you want to think about an atypical pneumonia under those circumstances, right? And usually typical pneumonias, right, tend to have like a lobar consolidation on a chest x-ray versus an atypical pneumonia that tends to have an interstitial infiltrate on a chest x-ray, right? The chest x-ray typically looks worse than the patient, right? And then there's aspiration pneumonias, right? You'll see this in people that have like obtunded states, like obtunded state risk factors. So, you know, alcoholic, right? Person that has a nasogastric tube, person that has a ventilator, right? The thing is, when you have an obtunded state, you're essentially suppressing the cough reflex, right? So that's, and that cough reflex really helps with clearing bugs. So if that cough reflex is inactivated, then you're in trouble, right? And then remember ventilators, right? Usually when people have aspiration pneumonias, it's usually from anaerobes, right? So they'll have like a foul smelling, like sputum or whatever. And then ventilators, right, also have an aspiration pneumonia, right? So, because essentially, right, like the person's respiration is bypassing like the airway, like the mucosal protective mechanisms that constitute your airway, right? So it's like you have this tube down your throat that is just sending the bugs right onto your lungs, right? So vents, right, are associated with pneumonias. And again, if a person has like an anaerobic pneumonial infection, right, you know, you can give them clindamycin. It's pretty good for aspiration pneumonias, but again, you can use many other things, right? And then there's this next slide I'm going to. I love these slides because, again, the thing is on NBMEs, right? It's not just memorizing things that helps. It's just being able to organize your information well, you know, kind of grouping your material the right way. So that's what I try to do with some of these slides. Trust me, this is not the last of the grouping slides that you're going to see in this podcast and in this series of videos, I guess, that you'll see for micro, right? So let's go through like these, I think like 30 pneumonia vignettes, right? If you know this list, you'll probably be able to answer most bug causes of pneumonia on any USMLE exam you ever take, right? So they give you a question about pneumonia in an immunocompromised patient or HIV patient. What bug are you thinking about? I hope you're thinking about pneumocystis rivetsi. In fact, your friends at the NBME have gotten a little crafty with this. They will give you questions where it's a person that doesn't have HIV, but they are on like chronic corticosteroid therapy for like resistant COPD, like really bad COPD or like some autoimmune disease. And then they develop like pneumonia and you see like interstitial infiltrates on imaging. If you see that, you absolutely want to think about pneumocystis rivetsi under those circumstances, right? And then what's the most common cause of walking pneumonia? Obviously, that's mycoplasma, right? Pneumonia in an alcoholic, right? No, again, think about an anaerobe from aspiration or think about Klebsiella pneumoniae, right? One thing I didn't put in here, but it just kind of dropped in my mind now, so I'm just going to say it. If you see pneumonia in a COPD patient, I want you to strongly consider Haemophilus influenzae as the cause. Okay, it's one of those weird, unusual, but floridly high yield associations to know for the USMLE exams. And then if you see pneumonia in an alcoholic, obtunded state foul smelling, that's an anaerobe, right? If you see interstitial pneumonia in a bird handler or a person that has a pet store, right? I would hope you're thinking about Chlamydophilus sedeci under those circumstances, like psittacosis. So PSI, double TECI, okay? And then pneumonia in the setting of bats or bat dropping exposure or spelunking. Spelunking just means you're exploring caves, right? Or you go to Kentucky or you go to Ohio or whatever. If you see that, then you want to think about histoplasmosis, right? So histoplasma capsulata. Remember, if you're a HIV patient and your CD4 count is less than 150 and you live in a susceptible area like Kentucky or Ohio, you do need to get itraconazole prophylaxis against histoplasma. That's a very high yield thing to know for exams. Now, pneumonia in the setting of a visit to like Southern California or New Mexico or West Texas or Las Vegas or whatever, or Arizona, I guess. If you see that, what are you thinking about? You should think about coccidiomycosis, right? Coccidioides immitis. I remember it forms the classic spherules on histology. Those pictures are high yield things to know for exams. I'll strongly encourage you to make sure you know those for exams. And then please don't forget that, again, if you live in a susceptible, in those susceptible areas and you have HIV and your CD4 count drops below 250, okay, you do need itraconazole prophylaxis. And also, for the purposes of the USMLE exams, do not forget that coccidiomycosis has an association with erythema nodosa, right? So like a painful lesion on the lower extremity. Remember, that's also found in people that have sarcoidosis. Now, pneumonia associated with red currant jelly sputum. This is easy. That's Klebsiella pneumonia. Pneumonia associated with rust-colored sputum, right? That's strep pneumo. That's easy as well. Pneumonia associated with air transmitted via air conditioning, or again, waterfall, business conference. That's Legionella, right? And then pneumonia in an individual with Q fever, right? That's Coxiella bornedii, right? And then pneumonia associated with cystic fibrosis and in ventilator patients. What is that? So again, if you're less than 20 years old, especially CF, less than 20 years old, think about Staph aureus, especially MRSA. But if you're greater than 20 years old, think about Pseudomonas aeruginosa. Okay. Now, pneumonia associated with hyponatremia, right? Again, it's not low yield, but I just kind of put that there. It's something that, you know, they tend to focus a lot on step 2 CK, but again, they're beginning to talk about this a lot on step 1. Think about Legionella. Three most common causes of atypical pneumonia, that's mycoplasma, that's number 1, chlamydia is number 2, and Legionella is number 3. And one nice mnemonic to kind of hold all those things down in your mind is, remember that all those bugs are treated with macrolids. And if you notice, if you capitalize the M, the C, and the L in a macrolid, then you essentially know all the causes of atypical pneumonia. Mycoplasma, chlamydia, and Legionella, right? And then pneumonia in a neonate with gram-positive coccus staining. What is that? That's group B strep, right? That's strep A galactiae. And then pneumonia in a neonate with gram-negative rod staining, that's E. coli, right? Remember, the three most common causes of pneumonia in neonates, we have group B strep as number 1, we have E. coli as number 2, and we have Listeria as number 3. Now, viral pneumonia in a kid that's less than a year old, and they may tell you in the MBME question that this child is wheezing. I think I may have misspoke in my first micro video and said that, oh, this person has strider for RSV. Think more about wheezing for RSV, not strider, okay? Because strider is more indicative of something like epiglottitis or croup, right? But wheezing, so strider means you have an upper airway problem. That's not going to be RSV. Wheezing means you have a lower airway problem. That's going to be RSV in a kid. If you see a little child with wheezing, pneumonia, you know, relatively high fevers, but not crazy high, think about RSV, okay? The respiratory syncytial virus. And remember that RSV, I think you can prophylax against it, especially in people that have like, maybe like CF or something, where they have like high risk problems that can set them up for like very bad morbidity and mortality when they're exposed to RSV. The drug you can use under those circumstances is known as palivizumab. It's a monoclonal antibody, okay, because it ends in a MAB, right? And then pneumonia in a wool solder, or you can say FBI agent, or they can say, oh, associated with hemorrhagic mediastinitis. What is this? This is anthrax, right? This is Bacillus anthracis. Remember, you treat that with a fluoroquinolone on an MBM exam. And then, most common cause of pneumonia in a young adult, don't say strep pneumo. Say mycoplasma, right? Mycoplasma is going to be the right answer on a test. And then, most common cause of pneumonia overall, a strep pneumo, right? A strep pneumo, there's like pneumo in the name. Okay, now, most common cause of viral pneumonia. Most common cause of viral pneumonia, right? This is very likely RSV, right? And then pneumonia of the lung abscess, right? Think about an anaerobe, right? Or think about Staph aureus, right? Anaerobes, Staph aureus, they love to cause abscesses with their pneumonias, right? And then pneumonia in an IV drug user, again, think about an anaerobe, think about Staph aureus. And remember that Staph aureus loves to cause pneumonia, especially with cavitation, like after a person just has the flu, right? Remember, the flu is not caused by H flu, it's caused by the actual, like, you know, influenza virus, okay? And then pneumonia associated with air fluid levels on chest x-ray. If you see that, again, think about some kind of anaerobe, okay? Think about some kind of anaerobe. And yeah, I think I've talked about pretty much all of this. You can just go through these answers. I'm going to attach the slides on the website, so you should be fine. Okay, now, next one. What is the organism that best matches the following info cluster, right? So, cellulite is secondary to an infection with an anaerobe, gas gangrene, food poisoning, produces alpha toxin. This is Clostridium perfringens, right? Causes gas gangrene. So if they give you a question about a person that has neck fash and they tell you about the person having crepitus on a test, you really want to think about C. perfringens on your exam. Okay, remember, it produces alpha toxin. Alpha toxin is a lecithinase, right? So it basically like chops up cell membranes. Okay, so let's keep going. Now, what is the organism that best matches the following info cluster? This bug causes a spastic paralysis. It prevents the release of GABA and glycine from inhibitory neurons. I think those are like the Renshaw cells. And then it's vaccine preventable. What do you think this is? Is this Clostridium botulinum? Or is this Clostridium tetany? I hope you're telling me Clostridium tetany, right? So remember, if you do not release these inhibitory neurotransmitters, then your nerves are all excited, right? So remember C. tetany, right? It cleaves. So this is one very awesome way your friends at the MBME can integrate cell biology and micro, right? The tetanus toxin cleaves snare proteins. And remember, you need those V snares and T snares to bring those bags of neurotransmitters, right? Those vesicles that contain neurotransmitter to the synapse, right? So if you cleave those snare proteins, you're not going to be able to bring those things like GABA and glycine, and then you'll be in an excitatory state. So you can have like the rhesus sardonicus and all that badness, right? Yeah, so that's the way this works. Okay, remember, the toxin is known as tetanospasmin, right? Spastic paralysis. Now, what is the organism that best matches the following information cluster? So the toxin prevents the release of acetylcholine, an adult that bought canned soup from a store, a baby that consumed honey. Right, it's easy. It's Clostridium botulinum, right? Again, cleave snare proteins, right? So you do not release acetylcholine at the neuromuscular junction, right? So this child will have a flaccid paralysis, right? Because their skeletal muscles are not able to contract, right? And it's super high yield to actually know three things here. First thing, adults that get botulism, they get it from the preformed toxin. It's not because the bug went and germinated in their GI tracts. No, it's not. Because the thing is, when you become an adult, your GI flora gets more robust, right? So you're able to outcompete and destroy C. botulinum, right? But if you get the preformed toxin, you're kind of out of options there, right? You get problems. But kids, right? Kids that get botulism, their GI tracts are not well developed, right? They don't have adequate amounts of GI flora, right? So they are more susceptible, right? The bug will germinate, make toxin, and then cause havoc. Okay, so it's very important to know those two key differences. And then the third thing I wanted to mention that just kind of dropped in my mind when I pulled up this slide is that they can actually present botulism as diarrhea in a kid, like diarrhea or constipation in a kid. So just kind of be mindful of that on an MBME exam. And they can also make botulism like a terrorist question where something was released in the air and the person has yada, yada, yada. Although I feel like when you're dealing with acetylcholine, they tend to go after nerve gas, which inhibits acetylcholinesterase. So you obviously get a cholinergic toxidrome, vomiting, diarrhea, sweating, all that stuff, right? Bradycardia, right? Okay, now let's do a clinical vignette. I love writing questions. A 23-year-old female presents with abdominal pain and intense diarrhea that started 3 days ago. Past medical history is unremarkable, save for recent treatment for respiratory infection that was notable for copious bouts of foul-smelling sputum. Empiric treatment is studied with subsequent resolution of her symptoms. The drug of choice that resolved this woman's symptoms is associated with which of the following side effects? So the first one, aplastic anemia. Second one, hypersensitivity skin reactions. Third answer, sensorineural hearing loss. Fourth answer, metallic taste in the posterior tongue. Fifth answer, diffuse flushing over the entire skin upon IV infusion of the drug. What am I referring to here? First, the thing is, whenever you're taking exams, the first thing you should always do, this is like the critical component that everyone seems to forget. Just make a diagnosis. Once you do that, you vastly increase your chances of getting the right answer. So hopefully you realize that this person took antibiotics and then they developed diarrhea. That's C. diff, right? If you see a person that develops a post-antibiotic diarrhea, it's always C. diff on an MBM exam, right? So Clostridium difficile, right? So what's the drug of choice for treating C. diff these days? I would really hope you're telling me vancomycin, right? So back in the day it was metronidazole, but that is no longer the case, okay? And the MBME reflects that these days, right? So the drug of choice for treating C. diff is vancomycin, right? So now you've made a diagnosis, you've come up with an answer, right? So you're like, okay, so let me find the answer that matches to vancomycin. That'll be option E, okay? Remember Redman syndrome with vancomycin, right? It's from an increased release of prostaglandins. So usually the way you kind of fix that is, you know, kind of like slow down the infusion of the vancomycin, because vancomycin is an IV formulation, using a ton in the ICU. Or you can also give an NSAID, because NSAIDs will inhibit cyclooxygenase. And if you inhibit COX, right, then you're not going to make those prostaglandins that cause the flushing and those symptoms you get with Redman syndrome, right? So the right answer here is E. Just to visit the other answers, option D, that's metronidazole, right? That's a good trick answer there. Remember, it causes like this metallic taste in the mouth. And remember, metronidazole also causes the disulfiram effect, right? What even happens? Metronidazole, right, has this thing where it can inhibit acetaldehyde dehydrogenase, right? So acetaldehyde will build up, right? So you feel like crap, right? That's why, again, you should not drink and take metronidazole, right? Although, you know, just be careful with drinking. Could kind of like kill your liver there, but that's a different conversation. And then sensorineural hearing loss, right? That's going to be like vancomycin, right? So vancomycin can cause ototoxicity, right? Maybe I should have written a better question here, actually. So vancomycin can cause ototoxicity, although when I wrote this answer choice, I was thinking more in terms of your aminoglycosides, right? Remember, your aminoglycosides are ototoxic, especially gentamicin. And then remember some loop diuretics as well, like ethacrynic acid, very ototoxic. And then don't forget your anti-cancer agent, cisplatin. Cisplatin is a platinum analog. It's a platinum agent. It's an alkylating agent. Okay, it can cause ototoxicity. So your ototoxic drugs, vancomycin, your aminoglycosides, cisplatin, the anti-cancer platinum analog, that also causes kidney problems that you can prevent with imifostin, and then also your, what was the last thing I mentioned? So aminoglycosides, vanc, and then your loops. Yep, your loop diuretics. Of all the loop diuretics, the one that's the most ototoxic is ethacrynic acid. But remember, that's the one that has no association with a sulfur side effect, right? And then hypersensitivity skin reactions, many antibiotics cause problems, especially like your penicillins. And any plastic anemia, that'll be chloramphenicol, right? That'll be chloramphenicol. Remember, chloramphenicol is a bacteriostatic 50S inhibitor, right? Again, I talk about these drugs in great detail in my pharmacology podcast. Okay, so I think I've kind of explained everything here, so I'm going to keep going. Okay. Now, what is the organism that best matches the... And let me actually talk about a test-taking strategy on this question, because I know some people may be saying, Divine, but you put option C, and you're still saying E. Let me ask you this. Between option C and option E, which is the most specific answer to this question? Like, what is the side effect here that is unique just to vancomycin? That's Redman syndrome, right? That's why E is correct, because many people make the same kind of test-taking error on exams, believe it or not, where, for example, I've given this example in a podcast before, where they ask you a question about a person that, you know, has esophageal adenocarcinoma, and they ask for the biggest risk factor, and then they give you an answer choice that says GERD, and then they give you an answer choice that says Barrett's, If you pick GERD, you'll be wrong. If you pick Barrett's, you'll be right. Both are correct, but the most specific answer to that question is Barrett's esophagus, right? So whenever you get like two very closely related answers, just ask yourself, which one is the closest? Which one is the most specific for the diagnosis that's encapsulated in the question? Go with that and you'll be correct. Okay, now what is the organism that best matches the following information cluster, right? So transmission via exposure to bodies of water containing animal urine. And I put a bunch of question marks and I say, oh, it's actually a legit hint. What am I talking about here? I hope you're telling me that this is leptospirosis, right? Leptospira interrogans. Basically, if they put Hawaii on any NBM exam, 99% of the time, the right answer is going to be leptospirosis, right? And again, leptospirosis, again, if you're exposed to water that has animal urine, then you're kind of in trouble. Again, don't forget it's a spirochete. So believe it or not, one means you can actually use to diagnose leptospirosis is with dark field microscopy, right? And it tends to cause like conjunctivitis, right? Tends to cause conjunctivitis, so like red, bilateral red eyes. And then sometimes it can invade the kidneys, right? And it can cause something called Wills disease, right? Wills disease, right? And the thing is, one sneaky thing your friends at the NBME could do to you on an exam is they can give you a leptospirosis question. And the person will have like a hemorrhagic mediastinitis. They'll have like a widened mediastinum. Or they may have like an ARDS-like picture where they have like a non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema, right? If you see that again, and they put it in the context of Hawaii, like a person going on a swimming expedition like a few days ago, whatever, in Hawaii, think about leptospirosis under those circumstances, right? So again, hemorrhagic mediastinitis is not only caused by anthrax, it can also be caused by leptospirosis on an NBME exam. Now, what is the organism that best matches the following info cluster? No cell wall, susceptible to treatment with erythromycin, chest x-ray shows diffuse interstitial infiltrates, patient has very mild symptoms. This is walking pneumonia. This is mycoplasma pneumoniae. End of story, right? Remember mycoplasma, right? Its cell wall contains a lot of like sterols, right? Which is unique. I mean, actually, it has no cell wall, right? Its cell membrane, let me put it that way, contains a ton of sterols, right? So it doesn't gram stain, okay? And again, person in their 20s to 40s, subacute atypical pneumonia, pick mycoplasma, okay? Pick mycoplasma. And again, it works, microlies work really well, right? And again, interstitial infiltrates because it's an atypical pneumonia. Okay. So what are some pneumonia generalities? Again, it's not 100% accurate, but I feel like this thing really does not work. There's almost very few, if any, circumstances where these generalities will not be accurate on your test, right? So if you see pneumonia in the super young, go with group B strep. If you don't see group B strep as an answer, so super young, I mean like the first like 20 days of life. If you don't see Strep A galactiae or group B strep, go for E. coli. If you don't see E. coli, go for Listeria. Okay, remember the drug of choice for treating Listeria is ampicillin, right? If you see a person with pneumonia in the 2 to 10 age range, think about like some kind of virus like RSV, right? If you see a pneumonia in like the teenage range to like, again, like early 40s, late 30s, that's mycoplasma. Older population, so a person that's in their 50s, 60s, yada, 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 think about strep pneumo, right? And then HIV patients, think of P. gervetzi. But pay attention here. This is something your friends at the NBME can do to you. If a person has a history of HIV and they have a pneumonia and you see a lobar consolidation, it is strep pneumo. In fact, let me surprise you here. The most common cause, this is very high up, the most common cause of pneumonia in HIV patients is strep pneumo. It's not P. gervetzi. So make sure if it's a lobar consolidation, it's not going to be pneumocystis. It's going to be strep pneumo. Okay, it's going to be strep pneumo. Very important to know that on tests, okay? The NBME can do you dirty like that. So definitely keep that at the back of your mind. Okay. Now, what is the organism that best matches the following info cluster, right? So conjunctivitis in neonates, lymphogranuloma verinarium, right? Blindness, urethritis in PID. And this bug will be treated with doxy or like doxycycline or macrolide. What bug are you thinking about? I would really hope you're thinking about chlamydial species under these circumstances. And for chlamydia, unfortunately, your friends at the NBME expect you to know the different serovars, right? So the serovars, S-E-R-O-V-A-R-S, those are just different types of chlamydia that tend to cause different kinds of infections, right? So if you see like urethritis and PID, those are the D through K serovars of chlamydia. If you see blindness, blindness will be the A through C serovars, right? So like chlamydia trachomatis, like trachoma, right? That's the A through C serovars. Conjunctivitis in a neonate, that means the neonate acquired the infection from the birth canal. So it's going to be the D through K servars. The lymphogranuloma venereum, that's the L1 through L3 servars, right? So that's something high you ought to know for exams. And again, doxy, macrolide. And one thing, one classic way your friends at the MBME love to put questions on chlamydia is they'll give you a question about a person that has an STI, and you take this person's discharge, you do a gram stain, and you don't find anything. If you don't see that, your job is done on an MBME exam. It's chlamydia, right? Because if it's Neisseria gonorrhea, you're going to see like the gram negative whatevers on histology, right? So if you don't see bugs, right, that's chlamydia. Like that's how they present it essentially all the time, right? There are very few chlamydia questions I've seen where they did not give it that presentation. I've even seen questions where it's like the person has a UTI, right? And again, you don't see anything. After you do a gram stain, right, and you're like, this is chlamydia, right? So again, just something to keep in mind for purposes of exams. Okay, so that's the classic exam presentation I'm talking about. You better make sure you know your servers, right? Now, chlamydia, right? So chlamydia, obligate intracellular organism, causes UTIs, right? So it's obligate intracellular because it needs ATP from the host, right? And you can actually detect it with the Ginza stain, like Borrelia, Rickettsia, chlamydia, trypanosomes, those can be detected with the Ginza stain. And again, it causes PID, right? Although don't forget Neisseria gonorrhea with that. Usually when people have gonococcal infection, they also tend to have like a concurrent chlamydial infection. And again, one way you can tell gonococcus apart from chlamydia is just to do a gram stain, right? Gonorrhea, you'll see the gram negative diplococci. Okay, now, again, sexual contact, vertical transmission from mom to fetus, right? And then drug of choice, give a doxycycline, give a macrolide. I already talked about why, again, you should never give tetracycline to a kid that's less than 8 years old or a pregnant woman, right? Because again, tooth discoloration, problems with bones, right? You don't want that, right? Now, again, people that have gonococcal infection, you usually treat them with one of two combos. Either ceftriaxone plus azithromycin or ceftriaxone plus doxycycline, okay? Ceftriaxone will cover the gonococcus, and then the azithromycin or doxycycline will cover the atypical organism, usually, again, in this case, chlamydia, right? And then if you're a sexual partner of a person with chlamydia, right, at least within the past 60 days, you also need to be treated, right? And one thing you want to know about for, especially for USM in step one, this is very unlikely to show up on step two, CK, or step three, is if, like this life cycle of chlamydia, right? So chlamydia has something called the elementary body that infects cells. That's the infective kind of chlamydia. And then when it gets in, right, it begins to replicate with the reticulate body. So remember the R in replicates. For the R in reticulate body, it replicates. And then when it's leaving, it just turns back to the elementary body before it goes and infects something else again. Okay, now what's the organism that best matches the following associations, right? So each of these things have specific answers to them. So diarrhea in an AIDS patient. What if I told you that this person had acid fast oocysts in the stool? What are you thinking about? This is Cryptosporidium parvum, right? Cryptosporidium. Please do not confuse Cryptosporidium with Cryptococcus on a test, right? You can see how people could kind of screw that up on an exam. And you can treat that with nitazoxanide, right? And usually it causes a watery diarrhea. Now, pneumonia in an AIDS patient, that's P. gervetzi, right? Meningitis in an AIDS patient, that's Cryptococcus neoformans, right? And back in the day, which is still correct on an MBM exam if you saw this, you can do the India ink stain, right, of CSF. But the thing that's done these days is you do the latex particle agglutination assay. Okay, I'll say that again. The latex particle agglutination assay is now the diagnostic test of choice for Cryptococcus, right? So if they give you an answer choice that has India ink and latex particle agglutination assay, go with latex particle agglutination assay, right? And the way we treat Cryptococcus is you don't mess around. Cryptococcus is rapidly fatal if it's not well treated. You go for amphoterrible, right? So amphotericin B and flucytosine, right? And then after they recover, you need to put them on fluconazole for about 12 months to reduce the risk of recurrence. Now, fever, cough, and night sweats with cavitation in the upper lobe of the lung. This is TB. That's easy. And then rash starts on the palms and soles and migrates centrally. That's Rocky Mountain spotted fever, right? From a Rickettsia rickettsii. Okay? From Rickettsia rickettsii. Okay. Let's move on. Now, this slide is ridiculously high yield to know for your exams, right? So like rush patterns, so let me kind of talk about them here. Just commit this to memory. You know, you memorize it, forget, but you know, just go over it a couple of times and it will kind of stick, right? So again, for a person who has like a rush on the palms, soles, and trunk after a painless chancre, that's secondary syphilis, right? If a person has like a sandpaper rash on the trunk, right? And then maybe they have like a clinical history of like a strawberry tongue. Think of scarlet fever from group A strep, right? So like strep pyogenes. If a person has a rash that starts on the face and migrates caudally, right? Think about measles. Although usually in the question, they will also mention like some of the three C's or all of the three C's, right? So the three C's of measles, right? Don't forget the cough. Don't forget the coryza. And don't forget the conjunctivitis, right? And it is ridiculously high yield to know for purposes of the USMLE exams that vitamin A decreases the morbidity and mortality associated with measles infection, right? And don't forget that measles is vaccine preventable, but you get it past the age of 1 year, right? Because it's a live attenuated vaccine, right? Live attenuated vaccines, you don't give those to pregnant women, and you do not give those to kids that are less than a year old, okay? That is just a nice rule to remember to keep many of these things straight, many of these vaccines straight on MBM exams. And then if they give you a question about a child, you know, that has like a measles, like, you know, had a measles infection back in the day, and then they tell you like, oh, like 10 years later, 15 years later, this child becomes like, starts deteriorating neurologically and begins to perform poorly in school and at some point becomes comatose and dies. If you see that, think about a disorder known as SSPE. It's a floridly high yield disorder to know for all the USMLE exams and also the pediatrics shelf in third year. That disorder is known as subacute sclerosing panencephalitis. I'll say that again. Subacute sclerosing panencephalitis. It's a high yield pathology to know for purposes of the USMLE exams. And then a rash that, again, you know, and again, the three C's, cough, coryza. Coryza is a $5 word for runny nose, and conjunctivitis. Those are the three C's of measles. And then a rash that starts on the palms and soles, radiates centrally, so from the outward in, right? That's Rocky Mountain spotted fever caused by Rickettsia rickettsii. Remember, for Rocky Mountain spotted fever, right, everyone gets doxycycline. With the exception of pregnant women, those people get chloramphenicol, okay? High yield to know that. So everyone, even if you're less than 80 years old, it doesn't matter, right? Rocky Mountain spotted fever is rapidly fatal if it doesn't get treated well. And then if a person has a rash on the hand, foot, and mouth, right, that's easy. That's Coxsackie A virus. Remember, Coxsackie A can also cause something called hepangina. Don't mix this up with Coxsackie B. Coxsackie B is the thing that causes myocarditis, which can ultimately lead to like a dilated cardiomyopathy and systolic heart failure, right? So you hear like an S3 heart sound after a person had like a recent upper respiratory infection. And about 50% of those people go into like heart failure. So myocarditis is actually pretty bad. Okay. Now, if a person has a rash that, you know, lasts for like 3 days, think about rubella under those circumstances. Remember, another name for rubella is German measles. Please do not mix up rubella and rubeola. Okay. Do not mix up rubella and rubeola on your exam. Rubeola is the measles I talked about before. Rubella is German measles. I know, it's annoying, right? So don't mix up rubella and rubeola. Rubeola is measles. And usually one dead giveaway on an MBM exam that, oh yeah, this person has got rubella, right, is they'll have like posterior auricular lymphadenopathy. So lymphadenopathy behind the ears. If you see that, think about rubella under those circumstances. Because again, right, kind of like measles, rush on the face goes downwards, right? But if you see posterior auricular lymphadenopathy, think about rubella. And don't forget, right, congenital rubella syndrome can cause like hearing problems. It can cause a patent ductus arteriosus. A PDA is one of those murmurs together with aortic regurgitation that will have an association with a white pulse pressure on an MBM exam. Again, these rush patterns, super high yield to know, right? Now, match the following STD buzzwords to the offending organism, right? So painless chancre or ulcer. So let's rush through this. I want to keep this podcast under an hour. So painless chancre or ulcer, that's syphilis, right? Treponema pallida. Granuloma inguinale is caused by what bug? That's Klebsiella granulomatis, right? I think this bug had an old name. If I'm remembering correctly, I think it was called like Kallimamobacterium something. Super long name. I'm glad it's been changed to Klebsiella granulomatis. Trust me, the alternative from back in the day was way worse. It was a terrible name. I don't know who named that, but I'm sure it's someone famous. Okay. Now, epithelial cells with inclusion bodies, right? This is herpes, this is HSV. Lymphogranuloma venereum, we already talked about this. This is chlamydia. These are the L1, L2, and L3 servers. And then genital warts, that's HPV. But remember, it's HPV 6 and 11. Remember, plantar warts are HPV 1 and 6. Genital warts are HPV 6 and 11. And then the HPV that causes like badness, right? Like cervical cancer, or basically any squamous cell cancer of the of most parts of the head and neck, and also like the genital area. Those will be HPV like 16, 18, and those in the 30s. And then urethral discharge, gram-negative diplococci, right? That's Neisseria gonorrhea. Diagnosis with doctoral microscopy, that's syphilis, T. pallidum, right? Painful ulcers, sorry, not painful, painless ulcers with no lymph node enlargement. This is Klebsiella granulomatis, right? Again, remember, you tend to have, I think these are Donovan buddies with Klebsiella granulomatis, right? Painful ulcers with bilateral inguinal lymphadenopathy. This one is easy, right? This one is probably Haemophilus ducreyi, right? Haemophilus ducreyi, remember, Haemophilus ducreyi makes you cry. That's a nice way to remember that. And you treat that with ceftriaxone, so third generation cephalosporin. And then painful vesicles on the genitalia, that's HSV, right? HSV2. Although they can also make it HSV1 on your test, right? So just be mindful of that. HSV1 can also cause genital herpes, right? And then painless genital ulcer that progresses to massive inguinal lymphadenopathy. These are buboes, right? This is lymphogranuloma venereum. This is, again, chlamydia, L1, L2, L3 cervars. And then urethral discharge in the setting of septic arthritis. This is going to be gonococcal infection. Drug of choice is doxycycline. Think about gonococcal infection. Think about chlamydia, right? And then drug of choice is ceftriaxone. Think about Neisseria gonorrhea. Okay. So those are your answers. So I'll encourage you to go through those. I hope you do. Okay. Now, the world of T. pallidum. I don't know. Syphilis is just high up to now. So I'm just going to review some things. And this slide, believe it or not, I got it from like an old slide I made back in the day. I mean, you can see the date stamp is what, like 2016? So this was when I was still in med school. So, but it's a good slide. It kind of summarizes a lot of high yield things well. So I'm just throwing it in here. I made it in one note, as you can probably guess at this point, right? So there are three stages of syphilis, right? There's primary syphilis, secondary, and tertiary, right? And again, remember, syphilis is treated with penicillin. So primary syphilis, painless chancre is contagious. Don't touch that with your hands. Congenital syphilis, right? A kid with snuffles, like a lot of like a newborn with a lot of rhinorrhea, a lot of snuffles. That's also syphilis as well. Again, don't touch those things with your bare hands. Essentially, you're touching those spirochetes and you're going to give yourself syphilis, essentially, right? So, you know, you kind of want to avoid that. Again, you may see Gothamus on this. Again, my apologies. So I went to Johns Hopkins for med school, and we're divided into colleges, and I was a member of Thomas College, which obviously was the best college. I mean, it was the best college, bar none. I'm sure I'm probably pissing off a few Hopkins folk, but whatever, doesn't matter. But yes, go Thomas, right? So yeah, that's why I put that in there. So that's primary syphilis. Secondary syphilis, maculopapular rash on the palms and soles. It can also cause condyloma lata. Again, please do not confuse condyloma lata with condyloma acuminata, right? Condyloma acuminata, that's HPV 6 and 11. Those are the genital warts. And again, syphilis is still contagious in the secondary phase. And then the way you do your testing, you do like your non-treponemal test. So the thing is, if you want to diagnose syphilis, you do like the treponemal test and the non-treponemal test, right? So the non-treponemal tests are your screening tests. Remember, in medicine, whenever you have a screening test, you need to follow it up with a confirmatory test. The screening tests are your non-treponemal tests, right? Those are things like RPR and VDRL, right? But your treponemal tests are for confirmation. They have like weird words like FTA ABS or MHATP, okay? But I promise you, you need to know those things for exams. They test these things all the time on MBMEs, on UWorld, everywhere. So you need to know it for a test, right? And then tertiary syphilis, that's where badness begins to happen. Like, you know, gummas, they have like tibis dorsalis where they destroy the dorsal columns, right? So those people have problems with like fine touch, vibration and proprioception. So they'll have a positive Romberg, right? You can also have aortitis, right? So again, like inflammation of the aorta. So they can get aortic dissection. They can get an ascending aortic aneurysm. Because the thing is, syphilis loves to infect the vasovisorum. Remember, the vasovisora are the blood vessels that supply big blood vessels, right? So it's like oxygen supply to a blood vessel, right? So if you destroy the vasovisorum, you begin to get ischemia of the aorta, especially the arch, and that can cause dilation of the aorta, right? And then the Argyro-Robertson pupil, right? So I'll talk about that some more in my neuro videos / podcast. I already have some, but I need to complete that series there. And then, again, I've talked about the diagnostic testing. The Argyro-Robertson pupils are the pupils that do not constrict to light, but they do accommodate. That's high yield to know for exams. And then congenital syphilis, again, newborn with snuffles, a lot of rhinorrhea. That's a classic thing on NBM exams. Don't forget the notched teeth. I think those are known as like Hutchinson's teeth, right? Don't forget the visual defects. Visual defects can happen. And then also these kids can actually die in utero. And since I talked about like screening tests for syphilis, non-treponemal, diagnostic or confirmatory test, treponema. I also thought I'll throw that in here for HIV. HIV, I mean, there are many new, much better tests for HIV now. But on MDMEs, they still almost like stick to the anidin, where like it's like the screening test, ELISA, the confirmatory test, Western blot for HIV, okay? So again, just kind of keep that at the back of your mind. That rule also applies to, there's this other bug, oh, come on, divine, think. Borrelia burgdorferi also has a similar business going on there. Screening test, ELISA, diagnostic, Western blot. Okay, let's keep chugging through. Oof, come on, divine, hurry up. Okay, so this slide is just some random stuff that's important. The NBM made me write this as a series of answers to kind of mess with your head, to do you dirty like that. So let me try to make sure you don't make those kinds of mistakes. These words all sound similar, but they all relate to completely different pathologies, right? So erythema chronicum migrans is the skin finding in Lyme disease, right? That's like the first stage of Lyme disease. That's the bullseye rash, right? Erythema marginatum, that's the skin finding in rheumatic fever caused by group A strep, okay, Streptococcus pyogenes. And then erythema infectiosum, okay, that's the slapped cheek rash that's associated with Parvo B19. Again, remember, Parvo B19 does not just show up in kids, it can also show up in adults, especially like children's teachers, like elementary school teachers. That's a classic presentation on MBMEs. And then ecthema gangrenosum, right? That's almost like the eschar that is associated with Pseudomonas, okay? So that's something to just, again, kind of keep in mind. Now, TB, right? So the mycobacterial species, I think is probably the last thing I'm actually going to focus on today. We're in slide 39, so we're almost done here. Okay, so again, the obligate aerobes, they love to infect the lung APCs because, as I will discuss in my POM videos / podcasts, I love POM. I will talk about how there is more oxygen tension at the apex of the lungs, right? So you want to go where there's the most oxygen, right? And again, the cell wall of mycobacterial species, they're rich in mycolic acids, right? So they are, it's acid fast, right? So it has the ability to take up like carbo fusion when you do the Zeal-Nielsen's thing. The Zeal-Nielsen's thing is the stain for mycobacterial species, especially Mycobacterium tuberculosis. And again, the big ones you want to keep here, MTB, right? So like Mycobacterium tuberculosis, Mycobacterium avium intracellulari, that's going to be a HIV patient. Mycobacterium marinum, right? So marinum, right? So like water exposure, Mycobacterium kansasii, and then Mycobacterium leprae. Classic presentation of Mycobacterium leprae on an MBM exam is the person will have like these, like they'll have like anesthesia, right? So they don't feel like cool parts of their body, right? So like over they may even have deformities over their ears, over their nose, they'll have chronic symptoms. That's leprosy. The way you treat leprosy is you treat it with like triple therapy. I call it my own triple therapy. And the mnemonic I use for that is DRC. I'm originally from Nigeria, so I'm African. So I'm familiar with the Democratic Republic of Congo, right? So DRC, remember that as a mnemonic for treating leprosy. The D stands for dapsone. The R stands for rifampin. And the C stands for clofazimine. I'll say that again. Dapsone, rifampin, and clofazimine. And I don't know. I just have this unction in my heart to talk about the uses of rifampin on an MME exam. Right? So you can use rifampin. And therapy for leprosy is 24 months, FYI. So don't get leprosy. Leprosy is bad. But basically, rifampin, you can use it for a few things on MBM exams. You can use it to treat TB, obviously, right? Like the RIPE regimen. You can use it to treat leprosy, the DRC regimen. You can also use rifampin as close contact prophylaxis of a person that has meningococcal meningitis, right? So like Neisseria meningitis. Rifampin is actually the drug of choice for treating close contacts or for prophylaxis in close contacts of people that have meningitis from Neisseria meningitidis. Okay. Other drugs you can use for that, you can use ciprofloxacin, you can use ceftriaxone, but rifampin is the preferred agent. But obviously, if you're pregnant, you're not going to be messing around with rifampin, you're not going to be messing around with ciprofloxacin, so you're going to go ceftriaxone under those circumstances. And then, again, TB, again, just fevers, night sweats, weight loss, you know, constitutional symptoms. Although if it's a hemonc style question, it's probably cancer. Oops. And again, TB or cell-mediated immunity takes care of TB, right? And again, TB, you get it through aerosolized secretions. Again, it's an obligated aerobe. Make sure you know the difference between a gun focus and a gun complex. The gun focus is the caseating granuloma, okay, that you get with TB, right? And then the gun complex is the gun focus, right? So the granuloma plus lymphadenopathy, right? The perihilar lymph nodes, that's the gun complex, right? And the thing is, if you have a gun complex, it means you've either had an infection that resolved, okay, or infection that's latent, right, or you have a current primary infection, although usually it's more like resolved infection or a current primary infection, right? And again, TB is treated with a multi-drug regimen, right? So you do the RIPE regimen, right? Basically, RIPE regimen is rifampin. Remember, that revs up cytochrome P450. That causes orange urine, right? That's nephrohepatotoxic. And then there is isoniazid. Remember, isoniazid depletes your B6, right? So if you deplete your B6, you can run into troubles, right? Well, why is that? Well, B6 is the cofactor for your transaminases in the liver. Like ALT, AST use B6 as a cofactor. So you can imagine liver toxicity happening with isoniazid. By depleting your B6, you will also have issues with heme synthesis. So remember, the rate-limiting enzyme of heme synthesis is ALE synthase. So aminolevulinic acid synthase that uses B6 as a cofactor, right? So if you don't have B6, it's not going to work. So you're going to get a ceroblastic anemia. And then if you're going from glutamate to GABA, remember glutamate is the excitatory neurotransmitter of your brain. GABA is the inhibitory neurotransmitter of your brain. Compare that with glycine, that's the inhibitory neurotransmitter of the spinal cord. In going from glutamate, which is an excitatory neurotransmitter, to GABA, which is an inhibitory neurotransmitter, you use an enzyme known as glutamate decarboxylase. GAD, glutamate decarboxylase, uses B6 as a cofactor. So if you don't have B6, you have more glutamate and less GABA. So you have seizures, right? So that's one of the neurotoxicities that are associated with isoniazid. You can also get like a, you know, peripheral neuropathy and all that badness, right? And then we have pyrazinamide, works well in acidic environments. And then we have ethambutol. Ethambutol tends to cause more like eye problems. That's the classic side effect. So if a person has like active TB, you use the RIPE regimen plus vitamin B6, okay? And you do that for 6 months. But the thing is, you use all of the RIPE plus vitamin B6 for the first 2 months. And then for the remaining 4 months, you use just rifampin, isoniazid, and B6, okay? And then if a person has latent TB, and here's how latent TB will present on the MBM exam, a person will have like a positive PPD skin test, okay? And then, so the person will have a positive PPD skin test, and then they'll tell you the chest X-ray is negative. If you see that, basically, if a person has a positive PPD skin test, your next step in diagnosis is always to get a chest X-ray. If the chest X-ray is negative, they have latent TB. If a person has latent TB, you treat them with isoniazid for 9 months plus vitamin B6. Okay, so that's therapy for latent TB. And then again, don't forget that rifampin again revs up cytochrome P450. You see rifampin, the R in rifampin for the R in revs. And again, I look at the time now, it's 63 minutes plus. I'm sorry, I'm going to round this up very soon. It's just all these things I'm telling you are just high yield information. And one thing you should get used to as you listen to my videos or podcasts is sometimes just other things just kind of drop in my mind that I never plan to talk about. So, but are high yield, so I'm going to talk about them. So again, I'm sorry. Rifampin revs up cytochrome P450. So they can classically give you like a question about a person that, you know, takes OCPs and then has a history of TB and then gets pregnant, right? The rifampin has increased the metabolism of the OCP, right? So it's no longer effective, essentially. Okay. And then isoniazid inhibits. So you see the I's match. So iron isoniazid for iron inhibits CEP450. Rifampin revs up cytochrome P450. And remember that isoniazid is also associated with... there's this thing that your friends at the MBMA love to test. Actually, two things. So they can test it in the context of biostats, especially on step one. It's one of Isoniazid is metabolized by acetylation, right? So it's one of those things where you can have slow acetylators and fast acetylators, like a bimodal distribution of something. They love to test that on NDMEs, especially in a biostats context. And then another thing is isoniazid. If you develop a Miller rash after you take isoniazid, that's drug-induced lupus, right? With your antihistone antibodies. And again, TB is hard to kill because, again, it's intracellular. And again, if your PPD is positive, it means you've been exposed to TB in some way, shape, or form. And don't forget your induration limits, right? So basically, right, people are like, oh, Divine, it's so hard to remember. It's tough, yada, yada, yada. Let me give you a trick. If you have induration that is more than 5 millimeters, think of an immunocompromised person being positive for TB. If you have induration of the skin that's more than 10 millimeters, think of people with chronic illness and healthcare workers. That's a nice classification system there. And then if you're more than 15 millimeters, then it's positive. Everyone, if your induration is more than 15 millimeters, you have TB, right? So let's talk about this for a second, right? So what is the thing I want to say here, right? So greater than 5 millimeters, positive in, again, immunocompromised folks, so folks with HIV, folks that have organ transplants, folks on immunosuppressants, not just for because they got organ transplants, but also people that just have like some autoimmune disease where they're taking an immunosuppressant. If their induration is more than 5 millimeters, you better believe that they have TB. And then more than 10 millimeters, healthcare workers, so like resident, med student, physician, and also people that have like chronic kidney disease, diabetes, and all that stuff. And then again, more than 15 millimeters is positive in everyone, right? And again, Aspergillus loves to form fungus balls in like TB cavities, but usually they'll give you like eosinophilia on your exam. And remember that aspergillosis is treated with like voriconazole or posaconazole, although if it's disseminated, invasive, you go with amphoterable under those circumstances. And again, remember that PPD skin test is an example of a type 4 hypersensitivity reaction. And then MAC, right? So like Mycobacterium avium intracellulare, if your CD4 count is less than 50, you prophylax against this with azithromycin. And then don't forget that MAC can also cause like hot tub lung. It's almost like a pneumonitis that arises in the setting of exposure to like hot tubs, right? So if a person seems to have like pulmonary symptoms that have this temporal association with them using like a hot tub or like a new community pool, think about Mycobacterium avium complex. And MAC also loves to affect elderly women. It can cause like a chronic pulmonary infection in an elderly female. That's a classic presentation as well. And then again, HIV patients, CD4 less than 50, okay? So please do not confuse hot tub lung that's caused by MAC with hot tub folliculitis that's caused by Pseudomonas aeruginosa, right? And then Mycobacterium marinum, super rare, kind of low yield. But if you see a skin infection, a person that works with water, think about Mycobacterium marinum. And just as a bonus here, Sporotrix Schenkii, right? If you see like skin lesions that almost seem to be traveling along a lymph node chain, right? Like circles traveling along a lymph node chain in a rose gardener or a person that works in a vegetable garden or something like that. Think about sporotrichosis, Sporotrix Schenkii, you treat that with itraconazole. So I think I'm going to go ahead and pause here. As I do at the end of every podcast, I offer one-on-one tutoring, on large group tutoring for a ton of exams. Step 1, 2CK, 2CS, Step 3, preclinical med school exams, third-year shelf exams. If you're a medicine resident, I tutor for the ABI and board exams and the internal medicine in-training exam. And then I also offer like booster courses, right? So it's 20 hours for step 1. It's 15 hours for step 2 CK and step 3. And again, it's just the course where I meet you one-on-one. We meet either for 1 hour each time or... Hope I've turned off my mic. Okay. So meet for 1 hour each time or 2 hours each time. And then we go over the must-knows for the USMLE exam that we are taking. Okay. And then if you're a college student and you need tutoring for the physics, general chemistry, organic chemistry, biochemistry, histology, physiology, offer tutoring for all those things. My tutor for the MCAT actually. So, and then if you're a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCAS app, or a med student applying for residency, so like an ERAS app, I do like one-on-one advising, coaching, for like rec letters, personal statement editing, mock interviews, editing applications. Again, I've been on the admissions committee of the top 2 med school for a year, so I have a lot of experience reviewing applications. And for the ERAS process, the vast majority, I'll say over 90%, of the people I've worked with have all matched at their first choices, right? So if you need any of that, feel free to reach out to me. And you can either reach out to me through the website or you can send me an email. This is probably preferable, but it's fine. Website works as well. I get either one. Divine Intervention Podcasts with an S at the end at gmail.com. So have a wonderful rest of your day. I am really hoping and praying that the Lakers beat the Celtics today. I was overjoyed on Saturday when they knocked down the Rockets. I hope Anthony Davis can come back. But, you know, we're playing pretty well in his absence. But that's a different discussion. So have a wonderful rest of your day. Thank you for listening to this. God bless you. I'll see you next time.